Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Sorghum is the smart choice. It's a resource-conserving crop.
Kansas producer Kim Baldwin on the sustainability of sorghum.
For us, we're coming out of a very dry 2020. I mean, we're still going to see the effects of this with our wheat crop that hopefully, knock on wood, we're still going to be harvesting this June, and we're about 3 weeks out from starting to plant corn and beans and, you know, then milo and sorghum. But yes, as far as the sustainability, sorghum sustains for us. We have, I would say, a moisture deficit for sure. And so whatever we have in the ground that we're trying to conserve to get our crops up and going, sorghum responds to what we have or what we don't have remaining in the ground.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I'll tell you, I get asked a lot, what's the biggest challenge we have in writing this farm bill?
House Ag Committee holding a listening session for the 2023 Farm Bill in Waco, Texas. And the president of the American Farm Bureau Federation, Zippy Duvall.
We have great committee members that serve on Ag Committee that want to do the right thing. I testified 4.5 hours a day. I think he was trying to see how tough I was. We had 52 congressmen asking questions. And I told him, I said, that's not a problem. This is a good thing, because they were interested in what needed to be in that farm bill. And I appreciated all 52 of them taking time to ask questions. The biggest challenge we face, because they're doing the listening, they're collecting the data, information. But the biggest challenge we face is there's 260 people in Congress on the House and Senate side that's never been involved in writing a farm bill. Now, all of you have kinfolk all over this country. You may not know their congressman or senator, but you need to call them, because they all went to the grocery store and saw naked shelves during COVID. Food security is national security. They're dependent on us. And that 73% that said that passing a farm bill was important to our country, important to them and their families, they need to know how important it is for them to reach out to their congressmen and senators, help these guys get a bipartisan solution this year and get it done. We can do this. We are the American farmer. Nothing can stop us.
Jasmine Crockett from Texas is a new member of the House Ag Committee, a Democrat from the Dallas area.
I just want to say that there was a comment that was made earlier about D.C. I think the gentleman is gone. No. Maybe he was sitting in this general area. It may have been you. And I'm sure a lot of you were thinking the same thing. And you said, listen, y'all have got so many differences. And then you said, but y'all agreed on this one thing, right? And I want to tell you that I truly believe that on this committee, we are all committed to actually getting this done. I know that there's a fear because there is so much divisiveness, but I am here to tell you that this committee, under this chairman's leadership, we are working really hard. And the reason that we're here is because what you say matters. And we understand, just like it's been reiterated over and over again, if you don't remember anything else from today, you should remember that food security really is national security. And so I'm just going to tell y'all a quick anecdote to that. I had an opportunity to go on what we call a CODEL. And so I went into the Middle East with colleagues. It's both sides of the aisle. And I was told this story about the fact that in this small country that is in the Middle East, there was a blockade in 2017. They were unable to get any food because the countries around them decided that they wanted to cut them off. And they decided, we've got to do this a different way. And so even though they are surrounded by salt water and they are in the desert, they thought, there's no way we can have our food be dependent upon anyone else getting it over to us. And I think that that is the best example of why it's so important that we understand, as it's already been mentioned, about even when we look at our soil and how the nitrates are coming out of Russia. Do we really want to rely upon Russia for something like our food supply? I would argue we probably don't want to. And so I would just say that I am so excited and so thankful for this opportunity. We hear you. We will get this done. I am assuring you of that.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We've always talked about trade. We've always talked about input costs. We've always talked about ways in which we could help farmers.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack speaking to corn, soybean, wheat, and sorghum producers at Commodity Classic.
But yet still today in a record year, 10%, 90%, we've got to do more. And I'm here today to make the case that more involves not just establishing and focusing on input costs, and we need to do that and we will. Not just focusing on trade because it's incredibly important, we will continue to do that. But we have to do more at the Department of Agriculture. The industry has to do more. And so I'm here today to suggest that the way to do this is to focus as well on additional income streams or market opportunities for producers. Taking that same farmstead, and instead of just relying on commodity sales or livestock sales or government payments, creating 3, 4, 5 different profit centers on that same farm. So that if commodity prices are not good, if there's drought or whatever it might be, there are other things that are providing income that aren't necessarily directly connected to that commodity. Without any additional work, if you will. That's one of the reasons why we promoted climate smart commodities. The notion of taking climate smart practices and producing a commodity that has an added value that the market will reflect and will pay. As you know, we put out $1 billion. We asked agriculture and we asked farmers and ranchers, how would you set this program up? You were pretty clear about it. You said it needed to be voluntary. It needed to be incentive-based. It needed to be market-oriented. And it needed to have a strong measurement, monitoring, reporting, and verification system. We put $1 billion out with that criteria, voluntary, market-driven, incentive-based, strong reporting, verification systems. Hoped that we would get some applications. We got over 1,000 applications. We were able to fund 141 of them. Every commodity is involved. Every state of the country is involved. We expect over 60,000 producers to be involved, 25 million acres. And what we're going to be able to do is to begin to establish a new concept that will provide additional income for farmers as they embrace climate smart practice, knowing full well that we have to provide the resources to embrace those climate smart practices, that we can't ask farmers to do it on their own. And so today, after this speech, I have an opportunity to witness the signing of some of the first two agreements. We're going to look at an agreement that the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation is leading, called Climate Smart Ag Commodity Partnership, an opportunity for farmers for soil health, a Climate Smart Commodity Partnership to focus on cover crops. They expect and anticipate to use this resource that we're providing to impact 1 million acres over 20 states. And the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation doing this in conjunction with the Corn Growers Association, the Soybean Board, conservation districts around the country. And we're also going to see the signing of the Midwest Climate Smart Commodity Program, where the Iowa Soybean Association is the lead. But they're working with Cargill, with PepsiCo and Target, market-oriented opportunities to develop customer-based and outcome-based contracts for soybean growers, for corn, for wheat, for sugar beets, to be able to provide the resources that a Pepsi and a Cargill need and that Target sells.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Contrary to how it's sometimes been described in retrospect, I don't believe that this policy was a result simply of naivete or wishful thinking or greed, although certainly there was plenty of each to go around.
Aaron Friedberg is a professor of politics at Princeton on how the U.S. and allies got it wrong with China.
The policy of engagement was instead the product of the convergence of a unique set of factors that came together at the end of the Cold War, and basically a mix of ideology and interests, but one in which I argue in the first two chapters of the book, the ideological elements played a decisive role. The growing influence of various industries and interest groups and individuals that benefited or expected to benefit from increasing trade and investment with China was certainly important in the foundation of this policy, But these material interests were bolstered and I think legitimized by a set of widely held, essentially liberal beliefs. The belief that trade is conducive to peace, that economic growth inevitably leads to political democracy, and particularly in the minds of American policymakers, the conviction that the moment had finally arrived when it might be possible to complete the construction of a truly global, all-encompassing liberal international order, which would require expanding the scope of the partial, geographically limited economic and political system of liberal states that had taken shape in the West during the Cold War, so that that system would finally and fully encompass all of the globe, so including the former Soviet Union, the parts of the former Soviet Empire, and all the way across Eurasia, including China as well.
On the first expectation,
the advocates of engagement argued that it would have three beneficial effects. First, by welcoming China into the prevailing international system, the belief was that the West, the United States, and other advanced industrial democracies could encourage China's leaders to see their interest as lying in the preservation and the stabilization of the existing order rather than any attempt to challenge or still less to overthrow it. So China was to be transformed into a status quo power, or in the term of art during the Bush administration, in which Corey and I both served, China would become a responsible stakeholder in the existing international order. So that was expectation number one.
Another expectation?
Number two, the belief was that as China was drawn into this increasingly globalized international economic system, there would be forces at work which would encourage a tendency which was already believed to be well in train, leading toward the eventual transformation of China's economy from a state-driven, state-directed one to one that was truly market-driven. And especially after China's entry into the World Trade Organization in 2001, I think the belief was that these forces leading to economic liberalization were unstoppable.
And finally.
And third and finally, and this is something that's become more controversial in retrospect, in my view, some people who said things at the time now say they didn't say them, but if you go back and check, they actually did. The belief that this incorporation, this engagement with China through a variety of mechanisms, would promote its eventual political liberalization. So economic liberalization would lead ultimately to political liberalization. So engagement would help China to grow richer and stronger, but as it did, the belief was that it wouldn't pose a threat to the prosperity, the security, the values of the United States and its democratic allies, because it would be transformed ultimately into a country that looked more or less like other democratic societies.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
To the lady who spoke about the heirs-related issue, I'm familiar with this issue.
Representative Austin Scott is from Georgia. He's a member of the House Ag Committee in Waco, Texas, for a House Ag Committee Farm Bill listening session.
Fort Valley State is just outside of my district. It's one of the HBCUs. I've had some conversation with leadership from that institution about the best way to solve that. If you have suggestions on how to solve it, I'm open to them. As you know, it's an extremely complex issue. With regard to those who are here on advocating on behalf of nutrition, I will tell you it bothers me that people, when they walk into the grocery store, they can't buy the same things for their family that I buy. I personally think it's ridiculous that you can buy Cokes and candy bars, but you can't buy rotisserie chicken or mashed potatoes. I do hope we're able to have that discussion as time pushes forward. For the producers, and man, we know we're all in this together, right? Because if we're not producing, then the people aren't eating. And if you're not farming today, the likelihood that you're going to be farming tomorrow is pretty slim. We can do some things with that, with beginning young and small farmers. But the fact of the matter is, it's going to be limited in how much success there is with getting the tonnage of food that we need. A couple of problems. I'll mention nitrogen. Number one producer is Russia. Russia is the number two producer of potash. Belarus is number three producer of potash. China is number four. We've got to do a better job of making sure that we're not dependent on any of these countries for the inputs in agriculture. That includes seed and chemicals. As for the current environment and how we help you address your risk, I think we need to move pretty quick to get the Olympic averages updated to reflect the current cost of production. And I think that we can do that with regard to reference prices and loan values for crops.
Another member of the House Ag Committee from Kansas, Tracy Mann.
My district is Kansas, the central and western part of the state of Kansas. Appreciate you, Chairman Thompson. Appreciate Pete Sessions. For those of you from Waco, you know, there's 435 members of Congress. I can tell you that few are more respected than Pete Sessions is on the floors of Congress. So you guys are very fortunate to be represented by him. I want to thank my wife and kids who are here today. It's our spring break. So the kids are here. I saw my five-year-old stretched out and fell asleep. And I would just say she wasn't the only person in the audience that fell asleep. And I'll just leave it at that. Quickly move on. Hey, food security is national security. And at the end of the day, this is about freedom. And we can never forget that one of the many reasons our country is a free country that we are is because we've never had to rely on another country for our food supply. We get it wrong. We mess up agriculture in this country, and we start having to rely on imports like we have to do for our oil, unfortunately. We're in an entirely different place as a nation. So this matters greatly. Crop insurance is going to be huge for me, and I hear that from many others. I think we got to acknowledge, you know, you look at reference prices and where we are. You know, the safety net is you know, let's just say it's 5 feet off the ground and it's developed. It's at that height to withstand a fall from 15 feet. But if you double, triple input costs, so you're falling from 30, 45 feet, you can do everything right. You can hit the net and you can still hit the ground and do serious damage. And so that's what we're really talking about here. And that's why every 5 years we got to open up the farm bill and really listen to producers and understand where the safety net's at and if it's at the appropriate height off the ground. We've got to get it right. This time is very important for us and the community to listen to you all to make sure that we get it right. And lastly, I would say I really appreciated practically everyone that got behind the microphone. They were there testifying on behalf of others, which says something about agriculture and our great rural communities.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We focus on competition also as a way of addressing this issue of 90% and 10%.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack speaking at Commodity Classic.
We've funded, as of this week, 31 processing facilities for meat, poultry, and processed eggs. All parts of the country. More to come, for sure.
While he admits all of this is important, major change is needed.
Instead of two or three ways of selling a crop and selling livestock and getting a government payment, you've got an opportunity for a climate-smart commodity. You've got an opportunity for an ecosystem service market. You have an opportunity for a bio-based product ingredient. You've got an opportunity for biofuels. You've got an opportunity for renewable energy production. So we're creating new markets, and all of this has been funded to get started by the American Rescue Plan resources, the Infrastructure Law, and the Inflation Reduction Act. This is a pivotal, historic, transformational moment for American agriculture. It really complements the ability to lower input costs. It complements the notion of trade. It expands significantly the entrepreneurial opportunities for small and mid-sized farming operations. It allows you to go in that dining room, around that coffee table with that hot cup of coffee, and talk to your sons and daughters and your grandkids about something exciting and incredibly important that's going to allow them to continue to do what you want them to do and what they want to do, which is to farm. It's going to continue to allow us to have family farming operations that can be transferred and continue to be transferred for 5, 6, 7, 8 generations. It's an exciting new opportunity. And it is right here. It is right now. It's a pivotal moment. And with the Farm Bill conversation coming up, what we have is the opportunity to ensure that these kinds of opportunities remain viable, an opportunity to expand significantly. So at the end of the day, we have a Farm Bill that doesn't benefit a few, but a Farm Bill that benefits the many and the most. That's the goal. Now, why do it? Why do it? Well, there's the obvious reason, which is we want to improve farm income. We don't want to have record years where not everybody benefits. By creating more markets and more profit opportunities, we can create more chances for farmers to actually make money. Why do it? Well, of course, there's the reason for additional rural jobs. But to me, what this is an opportunity to rebuild the middle class, the rural middle class. Now, why is that important? It's important for two reasons. And I say this to every audience I speak to. You've heard it before. You're going to hear it again because I just think it's an incredibly important point. Number one, every single person in this country, and there are roughly 320 million of us, who are not farmers. We don't farm. We never even thought about farming. We don't have to. Why? Because all we have to focus on is a paycheck. If we have a paycheck, it means we can go to a grocery store and we can buy everything we need for our families. So it gave us the freedom to think about, in my case, being a lawyer. In my wife Christy's case, being a teacher. It gave us that option. We didn't have to think about, my God, how am I going to produce something to feed our two sons? We just simply went to a grocery store. That is a tremendous gift that you all, the farmers, the ranchers, the producers of this great country, have provided to every single American.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Over the last 30 years, and indeed over the past half century, China's leaders have been remarkably constant in their objectives, but highly flexible in the means with which they've pursued them.
A timely discussion of China, Aaron Friedberg, professor of politics at Princeton.
And this, I think, is in marked contrast to the United States and the West more generally, which have been rigid with respect to both, so clinging until very recently to forlorn hopes and failed policies. The troubling trends in Beijing's behavior that have become unmistakable in the past decade under Xi Jinping actually have their origins a good bit earlier, in the first decade of the 21st century. In other words, these developments are not the handiwork of one man, but instead appear to reflect a broad consensus among the CCP's top leaders about what's necessary to meet changing conditions. And Xi is a convenient villain for many people, and in some respects, this is a hopeful interpretation, because if you believe it's all him, once he goes away, maybe things will get better. But in fact, it's the system of which he's a part, rather than the man himself, that's the root cause of our problems with the PRC. And finally, in each domain, political, economic, and strategic, recognition of what was actually happening has been delayed by prevailing misconceptions and stubborn expectations in the liberal democratic West. The belief that a determined Leninist regime would somehow permit multi-party democracy to take root and a true market-driven economy, which would by its nature undermine the power of the state, to emerge. And the belief also, and this one is particularly odd, I think, in retrospect, although many intelligent people, I think, held this view, that the People's Republic would somehow be content to become little more than a member in good standing of a U.S.-led and organized international system, one which, if you step back and look at it, is built on principles which are inimical to the legitimacy and potentially, therefore, to the survival of the CCP. The concluding chapter of the book digs more deeply into the question of why it's taken so long for the United States and other Western countries to acknowledge the failure of the policies that they've been pursuing for the past 30 years, and why things started to change when and how they did. And that's an interesting story in and of itself, and it's not one that's complete, because I don't think we've fully made this transformation. And in the concluding chapter, I also offer some prescriptions for the future. Again, I'd be happy to discuss those in more detail. But let me just close with my overarching conclusion, and I would frame it in this way. We, that is the United States and our democratic allies, have to begin by acknowledging that as happened after the First and Second World Wars, so also in the wake of the Cold War, our efforts to create an integrated and truly global liberal international order have failed. But, and this is the crucial caveat in my mind, instead of abandoning that project altogether, we need to fall back to a more defensible position, redrawing the perimeters and strengthening the boundaries of a geographically limited liberal international subsystem encompassing democracies in Europe, Asia, and North America, among other places, from which we can better promote our interests and protect our common values, much as we did at the start of the Cold War. In short, we need to avoid the lessons, or rather the mistakes, of the 20s and 30s when we lapsed back into isolation, and relearn the constructive lessons of the 1940s and 1950s.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
U.S. corn exports so far this marketing year are running
slower than expected.
Much slower than last season. USDA's Outlook Board has just cut another 75 million bushels off of its previous export forecast. Outlook Chairman Mark Jankowski told us,
typically, U.S. corn has a window from around January to March where we are the primary global supplier and we're most competitive. It's kind of our key season for exporting corn. And despite competitive U.S. prices, our exports just didn't meet expectations.
USDA is projecting corn export volume this season to be 1.85 billion bushels, 25% below last year. Meanwhile, USDA chopping a dime off its season average corn price forecast. It's now at $6.60 a bushel,
which historically is still a strong price.
Still 60 cents higher than last season. Gary Crawford, Washington.